You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this week's show, we're continuing our month of shows looking at genre in comics. Today, the subject is Westerns, and later in the show, in an interview recorded at this year's Bristol Small Press Expo, I'm talking to Tim Keeble and Andrew Cheverton about their ongoing comic West, which has recently included horror tropes and guest artists, and we're also talking about their future plans for the title and its graphic novel collections. Before that, I'm talking to veteran comics writer John Ostrander about his classic serialized graphic novel The Kents, which featured the history of Superman's great-grandparents in 19th century Kansas and their encounters with the Luthers of the time. The Kents is being re-released in 300-page giants this winter, so I'm talking to John about that, as well as his other examples of writing in the Western genre, Blaze of Glory, The Last Ride of the Western Heroes, Grimjack, and an unproduced Doctor Who audio Western. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of checks, radio, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
DC Comics are about to reprint your miniseries The Kents as 300-page giants. Do you know how this decision came about? Because I thought perhaps it was because they're now doing this Western comic set in ancient Gotham, then it might make a nice complimentary title to have one set in olden Smallville.
I actually have no idea what went into the decision. The first I knew about it was when it was solicited. Huh. On the other hand, it does make sense because the original story was told in 12 single-issue stories, but in three arcs of four issues each. So it, and I had planned it at that time that it'd either be gathered into formats like it's currently in or in the 12-issue format.
Mm. And it saw you collaborate with your regular Grimjack creator, Tim Truman, but he's an artist who's well known for working in the Western genre. So was that a genre you'd been looking forward to working with him on?
Well, with Tim, it's a question of, you know, anytime he's available to work on anything. You know, I would do romance comics with Tim if he had a mind to do them. Although I don't think he tends that way, but basically I just love working with Tim, and we've worked so long and so often. Of course, I know of his interest in historic Westerns as well. He did a wonderful two graphic novel series called Wilderness. Mm. And the amount of detail and research that he went into for that I just felt very confident that Tim would take to this like anything.
Mm. What gave you the idea to start off with to do a Western comic about the grandparents of the Kents and the Luthers?
Well, actually, I just wanted to do a Western because I was very into Westerns then. And the odd thing is, originally, I had pitched it as a background story for Deadshot. Mm. And using his past, because I figured, well, you know, they might be more likely to let me play around with the background of a character like that. But Peter Tomasi, who took the proposal after I'd been pitching it for years, he was very interested in it and became the editor for it. And he pitched it to the guy in charge, Paul Levitz, at the time. And Levitz was the one who suggested, well, wouldn't it make more money if it was about Superman and Clark Kent? And Peter relayed my concern was that, well, some of the ancestors may not be real nice people. And Levitz's reaction was, so? and once we were on that, going in that direction, I realized, you know, like, since the Kents are in Kansas, you know, well, how did they come to be in Kansas? And as I did more and more research, I realized that almost everything you could want in a Western took place in Kansas. So you had wonderful historical characters like Wild Bill Hickok. There you had the idea of the showdown at high noon on the street. Well, that was Hickok. And the initial cow towns were, you know, where the cowboys would drive the cats to. Those were all in Kansas: Abilene, Ellsworth, Dodge City. So, what more could he ask for? And plus the fact that both before and during the Civil War, it was a hotbed of intense activity. So, it just, the more research I did, the more plain it became that, oh yes, this is a wonderful place in order to set this story.
Other than Jonah Hex, there hadn't been a lot of Western comics from DC at that time. Was it a fairly easy pitch once you'd added the Superman mythology?
Well, you know, once, up until then, no, absolutely not. I had pitched it several times. And once Paul said, you know, like, well, you Superman. Once Paul was behind it, it was a really easy pitch, you know, and Paul made sure that they even pushed it pretty well. So I have to give him a lot of credit. You know, he got behind the series in a big way and really enabled us. He even gave me some choices of formats, whether or not I want to do it as for what they call prestige books or as 12 single issue stories. And I realized, given the scope of the story that I wanted to tell, I needed as many pages as I could get, so I went for the 12 monthly issues.
And you depicted the Kents as people who would take in waifs and strays back then. I guess, knowing what Jonathan and Martha would do with baby Kal-El, it was kind of obvious that they would be the people on the side of the Underground Railroad.
Yeah, it just seemed to me to be a pretty good fit, given given who the Kents turn out to be later on as well. But that also enabled me to work in the concept of the Underground Railroad, what it was, what it did, and people like Harriet Tubman. So I managed to get all of that in there as part of it. Also the fact that Massachusetts really financed there were societies in Massachusetts that financed abolitionists to go into Kansas, because at the time the question was, it was going to be a territory, and was it going to be a free state or was it going to be a slave state? And so they got a lot of people to go out and settle out there.
With the TV series Smallville that's finished recently, in a few episodes of that, maybe not so recently, but a few years ago, they started playing with the idea of Kryptonian iconography being buried beneath the ground in perhaps Indian burial grounds. And that was something that you introduced for the first time in your miniseries. Do you think that perhaps the makers of the TV show read your comic, or it was just one of those ideas that was bound to come up sooner or later?
I think it could have gone either way. I really don't know. I do know that particularly later on, there were some writers like Jeff Johns who were very familiar with my work. When he later on came in and did Justice Society and brought Amanda Waller into Smallville. So it's possible that they knew it. It's possible that they just extrapolated from existing data, as I did.
And then the next Western comic that you did after the Kents was A Blaze of Glory for Marvel. Had the Kents been a big enough success that other companies were saying, come and do a Western comic for us?
Well, it was a fair success. I, in my pride, said, since I was talking with Mark Bernardo over at Marvel, he asked me what I wanted to do. And I told, since I'd done a Western with DC, I now wanted to do a Western at Marvel, you know, just to see if I could. And lo and behold, they gave me a go-ahead with it. I gave them a pitch that they liked, and they said, all right.
Simple as that. And I guess Marvel had a larger range of Western characters that you could use in ongoing stories. But in a way, you managed to retcon some of the previous adventures by saying that they were fictions within the Marvel Universe itself.
Yeah, basically it's because, I mean, some of it just made no sense whatsoever. Even for the time, it was just sort of like, what? You know, they had a slave who so loved his masters that he fought for the Confederacy. Excuse me? What? What planet? I don't care what water that you're on. That didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So I just decided to play a little bit with all of that stuff. Basically, to add a little bit more realism to some characters that had been around since the 50s and 60s for the most part. Back when, you know, the real role model was the TV Westerns.
When it comes to Westerns, then, are you generally a purist that you want a Western to be a Western, or do you mind mixing it with other genres?
Well, there was a wonderful series a couple of years ago called Desperados that combined the idea of the fact that there might be a serial killer in the Old West. And I don't mind the idea of cowboys and aliens either. I think that's a brilliant title to begin with and a fun concept. So I think you can do lots of things with the Western genre. Historic Westerns are just one of them. What I did over at Marvel is what I call more of a movie Western, in that there was a touch of history in it, but it was more meant to be like an old-fashioned Western movie.
Because I read that a few years ago you were meant to be writing a Doctor Who radio play that was also a Western. Was that going to be a mixture of Western and science fiction, or was it just going to be the Doctor Who characters in a pure Western, as it were?
They didn't want any science fiction or horror aspects at all in it. And that became very hard to make work for me. They have said since then that they'd be interested in any sort of Western Doctor Who thing that I might come up with, but I don't know if they still would be at this point. I just don't know if that doesn't seem to be working for me. And I think the one time the Doctor Who went to the West, it was not the series that had the fondest memories for Doctor Who fans.
The first example of you writing something that was perhaps influenced by Westerns was Grimjack, in so much as it was your collaboration with Tim Truman, and you both had that common interest. Did you see any kind of Western influence on that series in the way that it told a science fiction narrative?
In fact, it's oddly enough, within Grimjack, and one of the influences of Doctor Who on Grimjack was the fact that we could do any kind of story I said that we wanted to, and we did a time-traveling Western. And that actually worked, I thought. But not only is it that the Western is an influence on Grimjack per se, but the whole notion of the hard-boiled detective is largely derived from the Western as well. The idea of the lone hero on the mean streets with his gun and his fist, you know, seeking justice. So there's very much a Western aspect just in that alone. And there's a big hard-boiled detective influence on Grimjack as well. So, yeah, you could say that the West's blueprints were all over Grimjack.
And in terms of you enjoying Westerns yourself, was it classic sort of John Ford Westerns that interest you, or was that actually the history of the period mainly?
For a long time, I wasn't into the Westerns per se, and it was my late wife, Kim Neal, who was very heavily into Westerns, who introduced me to the very good Western movies, you know, and directors and stuff like that. So I got into that, and I've always had an interest in history, and so particularly for the Kents, I started reading up on the actual history at the time, and I found it fascinating. There's so many good stories to be told from that era, factual stories, or these stories based upon the facts, you know, let alone the myth of the West.
Because most recently, for most of the last decade, you've been writing Star Wars comics. But do you think that now that there is the new DC that seems to have shown an interest in Westerns, and now that Marvel has brought back, for example, the Rawhide Kid, do you think companies might be amenable to publishing more Western comics?
I mean, certainly, Gene Palmiotti, Jonah Hex, has brought him into Gotham City, which I think is a real interesting concept. and I hopefully maybe at some point I can pitch to DC. I had ideas of what to do as sequels to the Kents as well, so maybe not so much Western, but more historical, and it would take us into what happened next with the family. But yeah, I should think that the Western is, I think, a very viable genre if done correctly. Whether or not, and there is a big market for like Western novels, stuff like that. So I don't know why Western comics, if you pitch it to the right audience, wouldn't be successful.
Cool. I mean, it was a pleasure talking to you.
I'm at the Bristol Small Press Expo in the Mercure Hotel in May 2011 and talking to Tim Keeble and Andrew Cheverton about their serialized graphic novel West. You're sort of halfway into volume two of West now. You've produced a hardback collection of the first one and presumably the second one. You've thought to have a certain number of chapters and you're going to collect that as well. I mean, when you first set out on this project, how long did you intend it to last in terms of having a beginning, a middle, and an end?
I didn't. It was a 6-page story.
Right.
That was it. Tim wanted to draw a cowboy story for was it Violent?
Yeah.
For Jay Ewells and Selena Locke, and it was a 6-page story with it ended on a gunfight. Mm. We didn't resolve the story. There was our character was left with an empty pistol. Facing down four other guys with loaded guns and bluffing them that he could kill them because they didn't know he didn't have any bullets. And I didn't have that. That's not an ending you can get out of. So it was a 6-page story, and Tim kept asking me what happened next. And the problem with that is that when it occurred to me as a story, that was the ending came to me first, and I just wrote up to that. I don't know what happened next, and I had to keep telling him I don't know what happens next. And within a week or so, I had another story that happened before that, and that's where the format comes from, and that's why we jump around in time. But the advantage of that is that we can actually add layers onto the story every time with references back and forth. So it's not by design, it's by accident, but it's a brilliant storytelling device, and it seems to work for most of the people who read it.
So those 6 pages, are they going to be the last 6 pages of the comic?
No, because I'd love for them to be, because I think that original story stands brilliantly. I love the idea of bluffing down a gang of people with no bullets. I think it would be a lovely ending for our guy, but what's happened since then is it's become such a convoluted story that inevitably I have discovered a way out of that story, and there are actually quite a few stories that take place after that. Cool. So for everybody who thought that was brilliant, I apologise, but we are going to tell the story that happens directly afterwards, and then for a few years after that as well.
I would just like to add to what Andy said. Initially, when we went to Caption in 2003, and that was when we both decided that we wanted to do a small press comic, and we talked about what we might do, what we were interested in, and at one point I just said, well, I'd like to do a story either about a Roman legion or about cowboys. And he said, oh, well, I don't like the idea of doing any of those things. I'm not interested. And then it was, oh, I've got a Western for you. And that was the original Believers. And then that got published. It's like, oh, I've got another one. Oh, and another one. And it seemed to sort of start to snowball. And his mind just went on to override, really. So
it's interesting reading the most recent issue of West, which is an anthology piece by different artists, and then reading the graphic novel collection, because although the first volume is by the pair of you, each chapter is subtly different in terms of its references of different types of Western story, whether it's influenced by spaghetti Westerns or it's something a little bit more supernatural or something more along the lines of a John Ford movie. Was that something you always intended when, even though it's a continuing narrative, when splitting it up into chapters?
It's basically because I have no attention span. if I could write one long Western in one style, I probably would, but it's nice that, you know, there are Leone Westerns, and there are, as you say, John Ford Westerns, but there are also Jonah Hex comics. And really, it's like any other sort of genre of fiction. You can tell whatever sort of stories you want. So when we had the Justice story, it was a ghost story. although mostly it's sort of part of it is a romance, and it was nice to actually do a romantic Western with ghosts in it. So it's an attention span thing, but also I think if people don't know what they're going to read issue per issue, which is quite, I think that's interesting in that, you know, a lot of people seem to enjoy that halfway through High Moon, which seemed to be about, you know, Indians chased by wolves, suddenly it was werewolves. Mm. And then, you know, a lot of people said in retrospect that should have been screamingly obvious, but because you'd introduced the wolves, it had covered that. And I think that's, you know, my interest is in making each story separate, but also, you know, you don't know whether you're going to get a romance, or the second issue was about racism and you know, business in the, you know, the Western style. Mm. You know, Tim had said at some point we're going to have to do a Civil War story. Mm. And that dictated two issues, because I don't think you can really do a Civil War story. When I originally wrote it, it had about two pages of battle scenes, and I think that's, like with any war story, that does a disservice, because we are setting it in a historical period where people got killed, and Tim actually said, well, I want to draw big battle scenes, but it's a bit more respectful of the, you know, that period in time. So, you know, each story, it dictates how it's approached and, you know, how it ends up being produced.
And presumably that has an effect on the way you draw it as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I have to say, when Andy started putting supernatural stories my way, I was like, oh, right. I hadn't seen that coming. The first story, Believers, was just a gunfight story, so I thought we'd be doing just traditional Western stories. And then we have the ghost story, then the werewolves, and so that was a bit of a shock to me at first. But also, I think as far as drawing it, it's often about what the story requires, but also who I'm reading at the time, whose work I'm looking at the time, often rubs off on me when I'm doing the work, quite unconsciously, really. I mean, I do hope that my persona does come through in the work, and it doesn't. Someone doesn't say, "Oh God, yeah, that looks a bit like, I don't know, Darwin Cook or whoever I happen to be reading at the time." So, yeah.
Well, because it's been a while since Western comics have been particularly popular, and certainly one of the chapters you say after Toth as a reference.
Yeah.
But I mean, the kind of the reference that I see most in it is Mobius's Blueberry comics.
Right.
You know, were you a fan of those, or is it okay?
Oh yeah, definitely a fan of the Blueberry comics. But it was really the cover that I did after Toth. There was an image I'd seen of the Toth had drawn of the original Sandman character. Okay. And just the way the shadow was on that drawing, and I thought, wow, there's a scene in this book where West is in a dark kind of back kind of room of a shop, and it would just be great, the light coming through the window and just very little actually there, so much black on the page, I thought would make a striking cover. And so it was more about that cover being after Toth than the story itself, which I would say, yeah, the story itself was much more Girard, as he calls himself, yeah, when he's right. Drawing Blueberry, yeah, yeah.
Because that issue, sorry, came out just after Toth had died.
Yeah.
Wasn't it? It was, you know, Toth had died, and I think that might have been part of it, because there was some sort of Toth panel at the convention we went to. There was a sort of memorial panel. So I think that's where that came from, wasn't it? It's a lovely cover.
And obviously, there have been hundreds of Westerns on film over the years, but in terms of doing research that gives your book more credibility, how much do the pair of you look at historical documents and daguerreotypes and maps and whatnot?
I normally don't. I don't introduce deliberately, you know, anachronistic things in it, but yeah, every once in a while a script will come back. I don't know how many times it's happened, but in discussion with Tim, before I've even written a full script, in discussion, he'll point out that, you know, that I can't have that happen or this happen. I can't think of any particular things that's really dramatically changed the script. And there's, you know, as often as not, we'll find out we were right anyway. That in distance, West is a rifleman, and I wanted him to actually use a scope on his rifle. And of course, that seemed to me, you know, wrong for the Civil War period, so I gave him a telescope. That was better, because when he sees a guy he recognises on the enemy battlefield through his scope, he drops the telescope in surprise. So visually, you know, that helped the story. And it was only after, you know, we'd drawn, was it after we'd drawn the whole thing?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
We discovered that they did actually attach scopes to the rifles in the traditional sniper rifle sense. So, you know, you do your best.
Yeah.
But in the latest issue, in Stray Bullets, I've got a story, Fort Erie, which is drawn by Warwick Johnson Cadwell. And it was always going to be set in a creaky old fort up in the mountains. And when I was trying to figure out which state it was set in and what sort of time period, I picked Kansas, which is going to open about, you know, a barrel of worms, because Kansas is traditionally known as the flattest state. And it doesn't have, you know, mountains. But I looked it up, and it's not even in the top 20 flattest states in America. And I'm expecting people to come up and, you know, say Kansas doesn't have hills and forts and what have you, because, of course, Fort Erie is itself a factual place, but ours is Erie with a Y. So, you know, the idea is that the universe story we're telling is not necessarily our universe. There are slight differences.
Okay.
Because obviously there are ghosts and werewolves for a start.
And in terms of your research, Tim, if you've been correcting Andrew, it sounds like you're a bit of a Western aficionado.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, years ago when I was a kid, I had the full-time life set of the History of the Old West, which I since got rid of and regretted that horrendously after we started doing West, but was lucky to actually pick up a couple of volumes recently, and that's been really useful for that sort of research and stuff. But yeah, also, I have to say, I do use a lot of reference from movies just to see the way the towns look, the way people dress. And so the thing which often surprises me is we do these stories and we do it in a rather crude, ramshackle West, but then when you see a movie or you look at photographs, you realise just how modern they were and how they had a lot more of the modern cons that we you know, we consider modern than you tend to remember. So I would say, if anything, the West that we depict is generally actually more primitive than it really was.
Well, I suppose there is that romanticisation of the primitive, you know, that is part and parcel of the whole genre. Yeah. And looking at the way that your line style has changed over the course of the story, the two most recent issues drawn by you, for example, there seems to be a lot of grayscale work that has sort of crept in as, I guess, a way of producing a different tone to that part of the story. I mean, is that something that you get in the scripts, or it's just something you decide in the rendering?
It's more about the fact that I always liked grayscale and grey tones, especially the different the dots and the lines that you get in old-style black and white comics. And I'd always wanted to add that into West. And I did put light grayscales in on some of the earlier stories using Photoshop. And then I discovered the Manga Studio program, which has got all these different tones. So suddenly I was able to do what I'd always wanted to do. And so I was able to do it first in the distance. And I've carried on with that in the Stray Bullets short story that we've done. And I will continue to use those tones in that story. I think it gives it another level, if you like, to the art.
And it seems, actually, you know, we're in a room full of small press creators, and increasingly the small press seem to be using colour. I don't know if it's because of technology becoming cheaper and printing becoming cheaper, but actually yours now seems to be a rare black and white comic, but in a way that's quite nice because it suits the subject matter, and particularly the way that you're using grey, for example. I mean, is that something that you guys have thought about, that, you know, black and white storytelling is something in a way that's neglected in comics from time to time?
We have had arguments about whether West was going to go in colour. Because, I think Tim obviously, as an artist, wants to experiment and grow and do other things. And at some point, I can't remember, my memory's awful, but it was months, if not a couple of years ago, when we'd realised that colour was coming in and becoming affordable to us. And the idea of colouring stuff. And I think what precipitated that was the idea of putting it online and maybe making it in colour. But anyway, it was, you know, Tim had come to me and said, you know, colour, and I had said no. And you know, my problem there is that, you know, I'm not the artist, it's not really my say, but we'd done five, six issues up until that point. It was in the break between volumes one and two. And it was mostly because I don't want to switch halfway through. I can't abide that sort of thing. I don't mind a gradual progression as Tim's, you know, introduced tone and his line work has become clearer, and that's fine. But switching to colour, but I think I agree. It's I see it as a black and white Western, although it's, you know, ours is probably a, you know, a bit more topically, you know, risque than that sort of genre of Western. But I think it's a black and white Western serial. In the well, like a movie serial would be. It's, you know, you get an instalment and it's self. Well, it used to be self-contained, but it's. I see it as a black and white comic. But we're very happy to have colour covers. That's the first thing we did between volumes was let Tim experiment with colour, and it makes the book just look so much nicer than it did before.
Yeah. Also, I think another aspect to that is that while we would be very, it would be very easy for us to change to colour in the comics, then when it came to collecting it as a trade, we'd have to. It would be way, way, way more expensive to then get it printed up as a trade, hardback as we do. And I think that's something which would definitely hold us back from doing colour. And Andy's right. I think once we've started in black and white, it makes it much more of a complete thing to actually go through the whole thing and finish it and have it as a black and white comic. I think if we ever did. Now, if it came to it, if I did want to use colour, I would only use colour in the way that, say, Darwin Cook's used it in the Hunter book, or
Frank Miller in Sin City.
Not so much Frank Miller in Sin City. He just puts blobs of red or yellow in, doesn't he? I was thinking more that those kind of one tones. There's the Gabriel Barthe in Casanova, where it's just black, white with green colour blocks in there, and I think that would be as far as I'd now want to go with West anyway, even if we did do that. And the grey tone works almost as well.
And I guess then when you collect volume 2 as a book, the colour covers will be something you'll only ever be able to see in the floppies, or will you have a colour section at the back?
I think it depends. We had a really good relationship with the printer that did the book. And it depends, you know, whether we reprint it and what we do with distribution as to whether that would ever change. I can't remember whether they had the opportunity to put a colour insert. But we had colour covers. For the first volume, we did limited editions with painted covers that were sold, I think, just in 25s or possibly even less than that. And they were reproduced in the back in black and white. And I think people just enjoyed having them. But yes, it's... I don't know. I've not seen any of these colour covers in grayscale or black and white, and whether they would actually reproduce. But at this point, the comics are just so that we've got something every 6 months to get us at conventions. because at one point we were going to switch to just doing it as 4 issues in a book. But of course, that doesn't keep you deadlined to every 6 months, and that's how come there was such a gap between volume 1 and 2. We had this ambitious plan that because the books are so much cheaper to print and sell. That it was actually, you know, it was a better value that we could offer customers than the comics turn out to be. But of course, it keeps us away from conventions for 2 years, and everybody assumes we've died, and it's probably not a good business practice.
Well, and also, I mean, you know, I've seen those 2000 AD collections where originally in the comic they'd have 2 pages in colour and the rest in black and white, and it looks awful in grayscale. You know, when you switch between one to the other, you know.
I think it's the Distance Part 2 is such a nice. You know, it's black and white and blue. I imagine that blue will go grey in the same way that Tim says that his grayscales could be given a colour hint like Darwin Cook uses. That would work. I'm not sure about the pastel picture of West on the Distance Part 1. It's not something we've thought of. These are for the people. We've actually, this weekend is the first time when people, I've had maybe half a dozen people over this weekend, ask us when the next book is coming out and which issues will be in it. And I've had to sort of say to them that the current issue probably won't be in the second book, but the third, because we've got it'll be obvious when the second book comes out, but there's a certain way we need the stories to happen that aren't in the same order as the comics. So we have already got people waiting for the trade. So the comics are good for the people who can't wait, but people aren't buying them necessarily for the covers, or they just want to read them in a book, and we appear to have got a diverse audience that they want to read the book or they want to read the comics, so hopefully it appeals to all of them.
Well, they are two very different products. I mean, the individual issues still have a small press aspect to them, the A5 format and, you know, the type of printing, but the book I could see very much stocked in any high street bookshop. I mean, have you had any kind of mainstream distribution for the book?
That was the printer that we did it let us, well, it's Biddles. There's no reason to keep them secret. They were absolutely brilliant, and they do a thing called Publisher's Choice, which is where you can get them done. They're digitally printed, but they're beautiful quality, and you can get them done in batches of 100, which is perfect for us because it's given us as many as we would want to sell on the website and over the tables. But the idea was at some point to get the ISBN and send a few copies to Diamond, or possibly just send a few of those copies to some publishers and see whether they want to take it on. Although, of course, that means that we've got editors and people telling us how to tell the story. And my worry is the first thing they'll tell me is to tell it in order, which misses the point.
Necessarily.
And possibly, but it's... I think we've looked at the Diamond page, and it's a lot of forms to fill in and things to get your head round. But we've had interesting talks with people, particularly this weekend, other distributors and ways of getting it into shops. But if I sent copies to Travelling Man and OK Comics, I'd spend all my time doing admin and accounting and not writing comics. So it's difficult because, as you say, it's nice that people like the book, and everybody seems to think that production values are lovely and it should be in shops. It's a matter of how much time and effort it costs us to talk to distributors and get that. It's not as simple as sending it to them and they accept it. There are all sorts of forms and complicated things that we've looked at on websites and realised we don't understand what they're asking us for.
How did the latest issue come about, where you have six artists doing six different locations within the one title?
I had some ideas for stories that weren't full issues and didn't really contribute to the story we're telling. So although every issue is separate, and sometimes it's a drama, sometimes it's a normal cowboy, sometimes it's werewolves, they all crisscross, and characters are referenced and events are referenced, so that the more you read, the more it all, obviously there is a big story behind that everybody can start to see come through. But there were four or five stories that didn't add to that and were probably short stories that weren't going to be a full issue. And the other thing is that we've got another long story coming up. Distance was written as 36 pages because it was meant to be published in a book.
Yeah.
And when we abandoned that, we decided to do it as two issues because there was a natural cliffhanger point in the middle that we could use. And I like the idea of just introducing our first cliffhanger without telling anybody it's going to be a cliffhanger, which is why the first issue doesn't say Distance Part 1 on it. The idea is people would think it was another standalone story and for the first time not be. So I've got another thing that at the moment it looks to be about 32 pages, but it's a big long gang ride into town where West will be the sheriff story. But this one I deliberately don't want to split in half. I'd like to give Tim the opportunity to do it as a big, small amount of panels per page, very slow paced story. But of course he can't draw 32 pages and keep to the two issues a year schedule. So. Those two things come together. I just thought, well, what we do is we take these stories that aren't ever going to get drawn and see if we can get some friends in to do it. So it was a matter of picking the people we thought would be best for those stories. And obviously Tim did one, and I decided if we were going to get other people in, I was going to draw one as well. So we picked out Emma Price and Warwick Johnson-Cadwell for those. And there was a story that Paul Rainey was going to do, which he was going to... He ended up swapping with the story Tim did, because it became obvious once I'd written them that tonally there was some comedic aspects that Paul would just draw so well. And the story that he was supposed to do was actually far more in the story of West, and it seemed only fair that Tim should get to draw that. So apart from a little bit of swapping around, and Jenica's story just came about because... while we were talking about it, we were sharing a table with Jenica at the last Birmingham Con. And I came up with a story over the weekend for her to do, told her about it, she said she would do it, and it was as easy as that.
Tim, did you liaise with the other artists at all in case they wanted to know how to draw things in the West universe?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think we did send... Did we send them some reference images of his face and things like that?
I mean, they were all familiar. They've got the comics and they've read them. But they didn't have all of them. So if somebody needed... Emma ended up having to draw Oslo Magnifico and his travelling wagon. And she didn't have that story in the book she had, so and she didn't have the comic. So what I would do was I would just crop out the panels that I have on my computer and say, here's a picture of that. And I mean, Jenica had to draw West and his wife as children. Now, Tim's never done that, so I basically picked the youngest that Tim had drawn them as teenagers and said, make them 8 years old. And she sketched me those. I emailed them to Tim. Tim said they were lovely, so she actually got to design characters that have never been drawn.
Okay.
And the lovely thing about that is that there will be further stories of that, so Tim will actually get to use Jenica's art as reference rather than the other way around.
Presumably that dialogue is something that's actually quite nice as an artist, as a sort of ongoing collaboration with not only Andrew as a writer, but other artists who sort of expand the mythology.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's just been a buzz to actually see what people have done with it when their pages came in. To see the way that somebody else approaches a West story was a bit quite educational as well, actually. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
I think that was part of the where we had chosen it, is that we did want to have a couple of women artists, because it can be, you know, comics can be a bit boy, and not in the small press though, of course, but you know, mainstream comics is a bit sort of male oriented, both in the readership and in the creators. And we have touched on, you know, we've got a couple of strong female characters in the few issues we've done. And although his wife, you know, she is the girl in the refrigerator character, she does unfortunately get killed and set him on a life of vengeance. He isn't the go out and kill them all guy. He doesn't immediately go out for vengeance. But we introduced a couple of other characters, female characters, are strong characters, and I wanted to represent that with female artists. So, but also it's, you know, Paul Rainey has got a very simple, clean, cartoony style, which I wanted, and Warwick has got, you know, that very expressionistic, scratchy style, and Jenica does manga, and Emma, which is lovely, is my wife particularly likes it, is Emma doesn't draw like you imagine a girl would draw. It's very strong, solid art. It's not girly art, which, so it was.
You're digging yourself a hole right there.
Am I? Do you think?
Well, just suggesting that if Emma is not a normal female artist because she doesn't draw girly art, that's suggesting that other women do draw girly art.
I don't think that's a disservice. I think a lot of the female artists here are, it's mostly manga style art, I think, and you know, Jenica represents that part of it. And Emma, I don't think, you know, if her name was not on that, you would automatically assume she was a female artist. And it's a beautifully done story, and it doesn't, you know, it's like the way we chose everybody else. They were, you know, all chosen for subverting expectations of what female artists would do. And even though Jenica does the manga-y art, it's not what you would expect from Western comics. So with all the artists that are in there, they're all sort of, you know, they were all of our first choices, which was nice. Nobody said too busy. And some of them actually came through with particularly good, you know, hard scheduling conflicts anyway. I've mispronounced scheduling.
Yes,
sorry. I'll hear about that in the way home.
Well, it's set in America.
So we got all of our first choice artists, and they were chosen for a bit of diversity, not only in the small press, but for not what you would expect from a Western comic as well.
Mm. Well, particularly having a manga style artist in there, it really brings to fore what I was saying earlier about different genres within the Western itself.
I think so. I'm not a. When I used to work in a comic shop, I read a lot of manga, and what put me off was the fact they never seemed to end. It was, you know, I really, one of my favorite was Battle Angel Alita, which I loved, and the story didn't end in volume one, and then there was volume two, and I think it was volume seven where I thought, if I'm not going to get to the end of the story, I don't know why I'm reading. So I sort of, I've never been a fan of it, but I think it is, what I've seen of it, it is always visually beautiful. And that's what I like about it. Jenica, I've worked with a couple of times on a couple of other short stories, and she always draws what you ask of her, and then throws in a couple of surprises as well. And there was a, particularly on her last page, there was a little bit of relettering that I was able to do, because she had drawn the final page far better than I had written it. And Tim does that a lot, and I think everybody in that issue had thrown those surprises in, and it's lovely to get the pages back. Because I always like to re-letter. I always like to letter, but redo the dialogue, because you never know what you're going to get back. And
well, you know, it's the old Marvel way.
It is. It's. sometimes, you know, I've overwritten. Tim, I get the pages back from Tim, and a simple expression on West's or anybody else's face will make the entire line of dialogue completely superfluous. And I often sort of find myself cutting the dialogue down and making it snappier. And so that's the thing I've done from the first comic I did, was because Tim told me how he had lettered and just said crack on. But what I found is a godsend is being able to make it much, much better than I had written it. And with respect, even as Tim had drawn it, it's, you know, he has drawn my script. But by the time I finished lettering it, looking at the art, it's far better than both of us would imagine. So I'm surprised most people don't take that opportunity. In mainstream comics, I mean, obviously, in the small press, it's all very hands-on. But why you would hand off your original script to a letterer based on the art and not take the opportunity to re-dialogue, it surprises me. It seems to me the final step in the process that is often missed in comics.
Well, and it happens in movies. They do rewrites on the set.
I wouldn't go back to it. There's a couple of collaborations I'm doing where other people will have to be lettering them in a book, and I've already asked the editor, you know, I don't want to letter it if somebody else is doing it, but I think, you know, I would want the opportunity to recraft my dialogue particularly, or resituate some balloons based on how the art comes in, because I've found it almost invaluable in making the final product, you know, just that final polish what it sometimes needs.
Obviously, you two have worked together for a while now. Because you know each other's strengths, you know how Tim can expand on something and maybe take it in its own direction, and conversely, you know that Andrew might re-letter a few panels after you've drawn them. Does that make the process a bit looser, that you'll leave actually a lot of what is happening in the storytelling just up to Tim in your writing your scripts?
No. if you'd have interviewed us yesterday morning when we were arguing about the next issue, it's difficult to know. I don't like to... What I found particularly with Tim is I don't like to overwrite, because then he doesn't have anything to feel that he's adding. And if he does add anything and I've overwritten it for a reason, then he's not illustrating the script I've written. So, I mean, we're on the phone constantly almost with each other. We live 15 minutes drive away from each other anyway, so our collaboration is particularly, you know, hands-on and, you know, collaborative, which obviously with the other artists was all via emails and sending images back and forth. But, yeah, the temptation is to overwrite and make sure... But I think what you've got to do is you've got to make sure that you describe accurately the bits you absolutely have to have. But if I'm, you know, sometimes I've written fight scenes and gunfight scenes in Tim, and as long as he kills the right people at the right time, it doesn't really matter if it doesn't follow every beat of action as I had imagined it. If I wanted it to look exactly as I imagined it in my head, then I should probably just draw it myself. So, you know, I've got to give him some leeway, otherwise he's not really, you know, getting the opportunity to add his you know, part for the collaboration.
I mean, actually, that's an interesting point. When we did the story in Stray Bullets, initially it was going to be 5 pages. And then Andy needed to add, or you wanted to add or expand, or was it cut either that or cut down what he was doing, which meant basically I had to make 2 pages. So, but Andy had written a bit which just said, okay, a gunfight ensues. And I was able... After roughing the pages out, I was able to actually take what was going to be the final page and make it the final 3 pages, just by expanding on the gunfight and then having the final page of him walking away into the snow being most of the page, one large panel on the final page. So it was, you know, there is that freedom, and he does allow me that freedom, which is great fun.
But when you drew a section of the anthology, you weren't tempted to ask your artist to write it, just to swap roles for a change?
No, I did phone up. Was it a phone up, or was it? It might have been a face-to-face conversation where we, you know, if Tim said he wasn't happy with other people, I mean, it was for Tim's benefit. Like I say, it was to get him ahead of schedule, so he benefited from it, and he's enjoyed seeing other people do it. But I felt that, you know, I couldn't steamroll it and just say there's a guest artist issue. I had to say to Tim, you know, are you okay with other people drawing West? Not only for your advantage, but they're taking, you know, I'm happy with it, but they're taking your visualizations particularly of West and a couple of other characters that have recurred into that story. And he was fine with it. And I'm not as gracious. I mean, we've had other people say, you know, I'd like to do a West story, because the thing about the small press is it's massively collaborative. And if it were like it seemed at the beginning, just standalone separate stories, possibly that would happen. But it's not. It's hugely interconnected and complicated. And also, no, it's mine, and I want to just be the person in charge of.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Tim Keeble and Andrew Cheverton's comic West is available in a hardback graphic novel reprinting the first series, and then individual comics from the second, which you can find at all good comic shops. Tim and Andy's latest West comic, Confederate Dead, is launching next weekend at the Thought Bubble Festival in Leeds, more information about which to follow, and you can find more information about West at www.angrycandy.co.uk. John Ostrander's comic, The Kents, is being reprinted in 3 volumes, with the first coming out in 2 weeks' time, with the second and third collections coming out in December and January. If you'd like to find out more about what John Ostrander's up to, please go to www.comicscommunity.com/boards/Ostrander. That's comicscommunity.com/boards/Ostrander. As part of Comica and their own ongoing comics program, Gosh Comics in Soho has a series of talks, signings and exhibitions taking place at their new shop in Berwick Street. Illustrator Richard Maguire will be in conversation with Stephen Appleby, a British newspaper cartoonist whose latest collection, The Coffee Table Book of Doom, has just been released through Square Peg. Richard Maguire is an international illustrator whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, McSweeney's and Art Spiegelman's classic Raw magazine. That's at Gosh from 7 p.m. on November the 14th. Then, at the same venue on November the 18th, I'm talking to a pair of German artists whose work has been translated in the UK by Blank Slate Books. Mowell is best known for his various comics, featuring the heroic electrician Rabbit, Sparky O'Hare, and also his new graphic novel, The Band, is being released shortly by Blank Slate. I'm also talking to Uli Osterill, the author of several graphic novels, the first of which to be translated in English is Hector Umbra, a sci-fi detective story. He's also a regular cartoonist for Playboy, and that's at Gosh on Berwick Street on Friday the 18th of November from 6 p.m. For more information about all the events taking place at Gosh, please go to goshlondon.com, and for Comica events in general, please go to comicafestival.com. For listeners in the north of England or people planning to travel to Leeds next weekend, Thought Bubble, the annual comic book convention in Leeds, starts tomorrow and continues until next Sunday. From Monday to Friday, there are various film screenings to do with comics around Leeds, and then from Wednesday to Friday, there's a 3-day academic comics conference called Comics Forum, which deals with such issues as sculpture and comic art, the portrayal of illness in comics, and materiality and virtuality on the printed page. Then, on Saturday the 19th and Sunday the 20th, there's a traditional 2-day comics conference taking place at the Savills Hall and Royal Armouries Hall in Leeds City Centre. On Saturday the 19th at 1 p.m, I'm hosting a Q&A on stage with comic book creator Tim Sale, best known for his various collaborations with writer Jeff Loeb on characters such as Spider-Man, the Hulk and Daredevil for Marvel, and a series of acclaimed Batman miniseries for DC. Then on the Sunday at 2 p.m, I'm hosting a panel about the ongoing sci-fi noir comic Elephant Men, and I'm talking to writer Richard Starkings and one of the artists, Boo Cook. Guests at the convention include Adam Hughes, Jeff Lemire, Posey Simmons, Gail Simone, Peter Milligan, Mark Buckingham, Roger Landridge, Simone Lear, Doug Braithwaite, Ian Churchill, Daryl Cunningham, Mary Tolbert, Brian Tolbert, and many more. For more information about Thought Bubble, please go to www.thoughtbubblefestival.com. If you'd like to hear an extended version of tonight's and all previous episodes of Panel Borders, please go to www.panelborders.wordpress.com. On next week's show, I'm talking to Neil Gaiman about science fiction, and that's at the regular time of 8 p.m, Sunday the 20th of November on Resonance FM. Panel Borders was recorded, edited, and introduced by Alex Fitch, and we'll be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.